It's God in whatever way that he chooses to reveal himself. And in some cases, it was through his creation. Pastor Chuck always points out something. He said, you can learn almost everything there is to learn about God through creation. There's one thing you can't learn about God through looking at creation, and that's mercy. The way that you learn what is central to God's character of God's glory is by looking at Jesus. And that's what we're going to do in this gospel. And that's what I think starting right off here about coming full of grace and truth. I've had lots of people tell me over the years the difference that has come in their life. Some people it's because they were here. Some people it was because they were someplace like this, that they said, we have come to know the real Jesus. And we realized that we didn't know the real Jesus. We knew stuff about Jesus. We knew Jesus as he was interpreted or filtered through human personalities and doctrine. But we've come to know the real Jesus. And of course, it's extremely liberating. And once you get a taste of that, you really, really can't go back. So that's why I love this gospel. John said, look, you guys, I stared at him. I studied him. I touched him. I watched him sweat. I watched him cool his dirty feet in a cool stream after walking through the dusty hills. I saw him so tired, he fell asleep in the middle of what to us fishermen was a hurricane. He was so tired. And then I saw him get up, stand up, and say to the storm, shut up. And it did. And he said, we stood outside a tomb where a guy was stinking because he was partially decomposed. And we saw this God-man say in the most heroic voice, Lazarus, get out of there. And he did. So John says, don't tell me he was a phantom. Me and my buddies, we had breakfast with him. He was real. Yes, he was killed. He was beat up. But that was all part of a plan. He allowed it to happen. The same one who cast thousands of demons with a word out of humans that were captive, that same one allowed himself to be spit on and beat up. All of that is wrapped up here in chapter 1 of John. Full of grace and truth. There's a repeated root word here. It's translated full here in verse 14. In verse 16, the noun form of it is fullness. The word here is the word pleres, P-L-E-R-E-S. Sandra brought a little table with her so she could write notes. I love that. If you all want to do that, that would make me thrilled. And fullness down in verse 16 is the word pleroma, P-L-E-R-O-M-A. They're the same root. It's a thrilling word. It's a word that's often used to describe the attributes of God. His love, his faithfulness, his power. Here's what the word means. It means an abundant supply. It's not a sliding scale word, it's just a big word. It means all that could ever possibly be needed. Interestingly, even the Hebrew Old Testament word means the same thing when it describes God. So when God has mercy, when God has grace and truth, all his warehouses are full. His house is full. He's stacking it in the streets. There's so much. There's more than could possibly ever be used. I was at a church one time that had a communion service. I just happened to be there that day. And when it wasn't that big of a church. It was big compared to us, but, you know, a couple hundred people. But they had the little communion cups spread out all over the front. There were thousands of them. And I thought, either this guy is delusional, or he put out advertisements and was planning on lots of people show up, or there's something else here. And he said, you probably noticed the thousands of communion cups and stacks of bread. He said, I just wanted something to get stuck in your head. He says, there's more than enough of whatever God has given us of himself. You could sit here and oink your little hearts out, and you couldn't use it all up. And it stuck with me, and I was in my 20s. 40 years it stuck with me. That's what this word means, full of grace and truth. Why is that important? Well, some of us, I'm not going to look at anybody in particular, but I know some of us raised in a legalistic family or legalistic religion feel like sometimes you ever get to the end of the day and feel like you have used up your entire allotment of mercy. The devil will tell me that. He'll say, son, or no, God's the one who calls me son. He calls me Robert. Robert Marcus. That's my middle name. He knows how humiliating it is for me to hear that. Robert Marcus, if I were you, I'd lay low right now. Because you know that whole mercy and grace thing you're looking for from God? You stretched the boundaries, man. If I were you, in fact, it'd probably be good if you didn't go to church. It'd probably be good if you just lay low and don't even try to get kissy face with God, because, you know, you are cruising on fumes, man. And I always run to these scriptures and I say, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm a bozo, but you know what? I could never exhaust all of the grace of God. And we sang a song about it this morning. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. It's a scripture. His mercies never come to an end. The word mercies is the Hebrew equivalent of the word grace. They are new every morning. New every morning. Do you ever need to hear that? Oh, I do. After all these years, I still do. The Hebrew word is the word chesed. C-H-E-S-E-D-H. Chesed. If you were here for our psalm study, the word appears over 100 times in the Psalms. Of all of the Hebrew words about God's character, it's the one that's the most central to God's character. It's the Hebrew equivalent of grace. Charis is the Greek word for grace. C-H-A-R-I-S. Undeserved favor. But chesed in Hebrew is an even richer, fuller word. In fact, it takes a whole page in my Hebrew commentary to tell you what this word means. It is God treating you as if you were his favorite child. Whether or not you are even related to him, or whether you've been good or whether you've been bad, or whether there are others that are better than you, It's that act of God of just lavishing loving attention on people. And of course, if he didn't do that to people that weren't his children, he wouldn't have any children, right? Remember John 1:12 says, to everyone that received and welcomed Jesus, God gave a gift, the privilege, the right to become his children. So we didn't walk in saying, okay, God, I'm your kid, because until we believe in Jesus, nobody's God's child. We're his creation. But we enter into relationship with him through believing in Jesus. And then he treats you like you're his favorite. You know why? Because you are. Jack is his favorite. I'm his favorite. Holly is his favorite. We know Abigail's his favorite. That's what the word chesed means. It's central to God's character. All the ways through, it's translated in the Psalms in my English Bible as loving kindness, unfailing love, mercy. It's a great word. It's grace in the Old Testament, basically, is what it is. This word, charis, or charis, is, I don't know if they've got as guttural of a sound for the CH as they do in Hebrew. Undeserved, unearned favor from God. God is so filled with grace. There's so much grace in his being, it can never be all used up. No matter how taxed the supply is, there's always plenty more. I love that. I still have trouble believing that. I still have this whole tank on empty, tank on full thing. That's what happens when you go to a church where you have to get saved every week, like I did growing up, where you feel like, man, if you can drag yourself in there, hopefully you'll have enough fumes left in your tank to get in and get saved again. And in that church, we had a Sunday night service, and sometimes I didn't even make it from Sunday morning to Sunday night without having to get saved again. I thought I have just used up all of God's mercy. Oh, how wrong I was. Oh, how mistaught I was. My favorite definition of this word grace came from my friend Stanley, who's in heaven now. He passed away a number of years ago. He was an Englishman, but you'd love Stanley. You'd love to just hear him talk. He was a very proper Englishman. He pastored the church that Charles Spurgeon used to pastor. He was a very well-respected Englishman, and he and I traveled together. Actually, every time he came to the United States, I traveled with him. Sherlock Holmes and Grizzly Adams was sort of like what it was like, you know, me and Stanley together. Mr. Proper Englishman in his little, you know, three-piece suit and me and my hair. Stanley said, grace, and I love this. He said, grace is God doing in you and for you and through you what you don't deserve, what you could never deserve, and what you cannot possibly do for yourself. Isn't that great? That's, you know, just to say undeserved favor is fabulous. But it's just big. It's a big, huge word just in New Testament Greek and the usage of it in the New Testament. It's a very big word. So Jesus, the Jesus that's holding the atomic particles of your body together, the Jesus that created with the word all of the billions of galaxies, the Jesus that's holding everything together, the Jesus that took temporarily on himself human flesh. When he came to represent God, which he did perfectly, he came filled with grace and truth. This word truth, it's a fat word as well. Aletheia is the Greek word, A-L-E-T-H-E-I-A. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. Aletheia. In Scripture, it is an absolute. Our culture has strayed so far that when automatically people of a certain age, if you even talk about truth, they're not thinking of something absolute at all. There are possessive words in our culture. Your truth, my truth, his truth. The truth in our culture isn't something that is absolute. I think you can get in trouble in our culture for just looking at something that's not true and saying, that's not true. That's how far off the mark we are. Three primary applications of this word, aletheia. It's an important word in John's gospel. He uses it 25 times. Its primary meaning is that it is the opposite of falsehood or error. Synonyms would be regarding as an adjective, would be accurate or indisputable. Another application of aletheia, it is the opposite of mere appearance. And I love this because it means real, not imaginary. It's thrilling to me. I almost sang the song this morning. I forgot a lot of songs this morning. In Philippians chapter 4, remember the four P's? What to do instead of worrying? You know, present everything to God with prayer and specific petitions and thanksgiving. Present your request to the Lord, and the peace of God, which surpasses your ability to understand everything, will guard your minds and your hearts in Christ Jesus. The very next verse, 4:8, says, whatever things are true, noble, blah, blah, blah. I don't have the exact quote, but I always get hung up on the word true because it's the same root as this word. And when it's talking about not worrying, please track with me. When it's talking about not worrying, refusing to be anxious, it tells you what kind of stuff to think about in 4:8. And it says, fill your mind with things that are true. And it's speaking of real versus imaginary. This was hugely revealing to me when I realized that most of my worries had to do with things that were not even real. What if? What if the check doesn't come? What if I get such and such a disease? What if? You know what? Folks, none of that stuff is real. It might be someday. It might not be someday. If I fill my mind with the things that are real today, that's going to shoot about 98% of all my worries, isn't it? So, free little Bible study, no charge for that one. That was for the worry warts among you. Set me free. That's part of this root for this word, aletheia. The third application of it is integrity or honesty. Why am I saying all of that? Well, Jesus is filled with it more than could ever be possibly used up. But he said something even more astonishing. He said, I am the truth. I am the way. I am the truth. The definite article, the truth. I am the embodiment of it. Boy, if you ever want to just see how open-minded and tolerant people are, run a few of those statements by them that Jesus made. Almost all my New Age friends, and I do have many of them, they like my hair. They like how unconventional. They like the artistry and the Celtic music and all of that stuff. They really like it. And they even like some of the teaching of Jesus. The only problem they have is when Jesus said, I am the only way to come to God. I am the truth. Everything that calls itself truth has to align with me. That, then they have a problem with that. But see, Jesus designed it that way so that we couldn't just be indifferent. He forces you to have to consider what he says. So John says here he came filled with grace, more than could ever be used up, filled with truth. And later on, Jesus is going to say, look, I am the truth. Everything that is true in every sense of what aletheia means will align itself with me. In fact, remember what Jesus said to Pilate? He said, everybody who is really on the side of the truth listens to me. Wow. So, President Obama, are you listening to Jesus? So, pretenders to the throne, wannabes, are you listening to Jesus? Talk show hosts, theologians, are you listening to Jesus? Are you really on the side of the truth? Ask myself that question. Do I just have something I want to say? am I listening to him? So that's the second half of verse 14. And of course, he said, and we studied him. We saw it all. He was real. He was no phantom. No stinking way. It was an imagination. And then this little excerpt about John, the riddle. Who was the fairy tale character that asked riddles? Or was it Alice in Wonderland, I'm thinking? One of the characters in Alice in Wonderland asked riddles. Or maybe I'm thinking of Tolkien. Oh, Rumpelstiltskin, yes. That's right. Hey, who would have thought Richard would know Rumpelstiltskin? It's the whole hair thing. I don't know. But yeah, Rumpelstiltskin asking the riddles. Doesn't that sound like this? He said, John testifies, John the Baptist, used to be my hero, used to be a disciple of his, John the Apostle is saying. He told us one time, this is the guy. He's the guy I was talking about when I said there's one coming after me. Let me read this properly. Who has surpassed me because he was before me. Coming after me in age, John the Baptist was 6 months older than Jesus. He has surpassed me in rank because he was before me in existence. There's a conundrum for you. Yeah, I was born 6 months before him, technically. In the body, I was. But the reason that he so far surpassed me is before he took on a body, he already was in existence. For some reason, this stuck in John the Apostle's mind after all these years, so much that he uses present tense. One commentary that I read says, when John uses present tense, saying John the Baptist testifies, cries out, he's saying John the Baptist's words are still ringing in some of our ears. I've seen that. Have you seen that in your life? Somebody said something to you a long time ago that was so true, and it came so in contrast to all the lies that you'd heard that is still ringing in your ears. I have people like that in my life. Thank God for them. I was so clueless when God brought them across my path. But they said something that was so true, and I was so filled with error that those words are still to this day ringing in my ears. I think that's what John's saying. So Jesus, the Word, came full of grace and truth. And verse 16, and from the fullness, pleroma, of his grace, we have all received. Just let me read it to you in the Amplified. It's just so great. Out of his fullness, abundance, we have all received, we've all had a share, we were all supplied with one grace after another, and spiritual blessing upon spiritual blessing, and even favor upon favor, and gift heaped upon gift. English is such a watered-down language.